that there will continue to be scrambles for selling any kind of products or services even remotely related to big ticket arms sales. So in those two areas, you have been completely successful.
Hell yes, said Kuga. But before he could say more, Sunday held up a finger.
Let me finish my thought, said Sunday smoothly. Had you been better positioned when Kuga began trending on social media, you would have profited significantly more than you have. I'm not saying you didn't get a nice bump in sales via the dark web. Of course you did. There are plenty of people prone to impulse purchases, and lots of small, angry groups with stolen funds burning holes in their pockets. However, have you really seen a sales jump commensurate with the grandeur of what you accomplished? No, gentlemen. I am willing to bet the whole farm that you haven't.
Santoro saw Kuga go pale and then slowly flush with anger and embarrassment.
And I'm guessing that's why you fellows called me in, said a beaming Sunday. Am I right? Or am I right?
Chapter 6. Phoenix House, headquarters of Rogue Team International, Amphorae Island, Greece. The TOC, the Tactical Operations Center, was fully staffed by the best and the brightest. Mr. Church did not hire second-string players. 56 people sat at computer workstations of varying complexity and function, each of them set in concentric half-circles, arranged to face a wall of high-def screens. There was a massive central screen that ran from floor to ceiling and displayed images with astounding clarity and detail. Dozens of smaller screens ringed it, and pop-up windows appeared here and there. Data crawls ran across the bottom and top of the big screen. The sheer amount of information presented at any given moment was extraordinary, but each technician, specialist, and scientist in the talk was able to process their part without confusion or overload. Mr. Church stood apart from all the others. He was bigger than everyone else in the room, broad-shouldered and barrel-chested, giving him a blocky presence. His suit was a superbly cut chiton two-piece with a light gray check over dark blue wool and an Ermengilda Zegna Quindici silk tie. Church's hair was dark but streaked with gray, and he wore tinted glasses. He also wore very thin black silk gloves over hands that had been badly damaged on a case some years before. As the team worked, compiling and sharing data, talking into mics, or tapping away at keyboards, Church seemed to be a calm eye in the storm of activity. He stood with his hands clasped lightly behind his back, eyes hidden behind the glasses, features composed and unreadable. On the screen, thermal imaging, video feeds from bird drones, and data from RFID chips composed a picture of Havoc Team in play. Bell in a tower covering the front and side of the house with her rifle hidden in shadows. Andrea walking the perimeter, moving from one patch of darkness to another with deceptive ease, while inside four red dots indicated that Top and Bunny were in a hallway on the same floor as Joe Ledger and Ghost. The team channel was not synced into the talk, but Church was listening nonetheless. He had access to every channel and listened quietly to what had just happened. First, there was the false sighting of a man in the woods, and now the pause outside the master bedroom. Something was wrong, and Church had the feeling it was going to get worse. He wasn't sure what was going to happen, but his instincts, grown sharp over many years, were telling him to pull Ledger out now. He almost did. Almost. But he did not. He wondered if he was being efficient or cruel, or perhaps both. Chapter 7. Thirstenic Island, Croatia. I turned the knob and stepped very quietly into what was clearly the master bedroom. Mislav Mitrovich, naked and hairy, lay on an acre of bed, a huge four-poster draped with expensive hand-painted silks and brocades with gold lace. A woman lay curled into a fetal position on the side of the bed, as far from him as was possible, her bent knees and elbows hanging inches over the side. There were candles guttering on a table, and the room stank of wine, roast meat, sweat, and sex. Clothing was scattered everywhere, and most of the feminine garments looked torn. I positioned Ghost at the door as I crept over to the bed, coming up at an angle so that one of the thick, ornately carved wooden posts provided cover. The closer I got, the more I could read the scene. The woman was not a woman. She was a girl. Young teen, maybe 13 or 14, with a premature heft of breast and curves from lingering baby fat. There were bruises and suck marks on her shoulders and thighs, but the face was a child's, though painted like a B-movie stripper. Tears had streaked the mascara, and the mouth was puffy from hard use. She was deep inside a dream that made her body tremble and twitch. It did not look like a happy dream. I shot the young woman. No choice. If she woke up and screamed, then things would go straight into the crapper. Worst case scenario was that we took her with us when we left. She was clearly underage and had been abused. Scott Wilson, the COO of RTI, had contacts everywhere, and he'd be able to make sure she was properly treated and cared for. Scott had a wife and three daughters, the oldest of whom was about this kid's age. The Sandman dart hit her on the hip, and her twitching immediately stopped as she dropped deeper into the well of dreams. That left Mitrovich. He didn't stir when I darted the girl. Good. I holstered the pistol and drew my Wilson rapid response knife, snapped the blade into place, clamped my hand over Mitrovich's mouth, and laid the edge of the blade against his throat. That woke him right up. Make a sound and I'll kill you, I said in Croatian. Not one of my best languages, but I'd brushed up during mission prep. His eyes popped open, and every muscle in his body went rigid. I clicked my tongue, and Ghost jumped up onto the bed and bared his teeth. Six of them are made of titanium, souvenirs from having lost the original teeth in combat. Ghost loves showing those fangs. He straddled Mitrovich's thighs and lowered his head, so those teeth were inches from a quickly shriveling penis. Not surprisingly, Mitrovich did not make a sound. I'm going to remove my hand, I said, and then switched to English because I knew he was a polyglot. I spoke clearly and slowly, watching his eyes to make sure he understood. There was no confusion, only fear. If you yell or call for help, my dog is going to bite your dick off. Blink once if you believe me. Good. Now, blink once if you promise not to do something very, very stupid. Okay, good. Now we're communicating. I took my hand away but left the knife in place. Tell me what you're doing downstairs, I said. Lie to me and chomp, chomp. He stared at me in horror. Up close, his face looked different from that of his pictures. His eyes were slightly out of alignment, one tilted and more deeply set than the other. There were some old acne scars, and the caps on his front teeth did not precisely match the adjoining natural ones. Those details made him look more human and more vulnerable. However, it didn't stir any sympathy from me. Mitrovich stared at me, and I could see, even beneath the terror, a calculator brain assessing the situation, reviewing the odds, and evaluating his options. I was not wearing the uniform of any government, military, or law enforcement agency. I wore no insignias or patches of any kind. My gear was high-end, but of a kind he would not have seen before. Church doesn't buy off the rack. The scout glasses were also unknown to him. I wondered if he was mentally labeling me as a PMC, private military contractor and wondering what it would cost to buy the pink slip on my soul. "Don't make me ask again," I said.
"They'll kill me," he said.
"So will I. And I'm right here."
"So are they," he said.
It was a jolt and made me want to turn and look over my shoulder, but if there had been someone hiding in a secret compartment in the wall, Ghost would have sniffed it and given me a signal.
"Is the room bugged?"
I asked.
"I don't know," said Mitrovich. "They always seem to know."
I used my free hand to tap into the team channel. "Outlaw to Pappy report.
Donnie Darko and I just finished a sweep of the rest of this floor," said Top. "All clear.
I'm in the master bedroom. Find me."
"Copy that."
And a moment later, the door opened and the two of them came in. Bunny lingered in the doorway to watch the hall. Top came over and looked down at the naked girl. Unlike me, Top is a father. And that makes him a different kind of person. He touched the small, raised lump on her hip where I darted her, nodded to himself, took a sheet and pulled it over her. Then he removed one glove and pressed fingers into her carotid and nodded again. When he raised his head, I could almost hear his neck muscles creak.
"What's the play?"
he asked in a totally arctic voice. "Sweep the room for bugs." Top produced his device and carefully ran it over all the walls, cabinets, bedposts, and chairs. He flipped over a heavy leather recliner and pointed to a very small and sophisticated bug hidden behind a strut. He left it in place and finished his search, finding another in the wall nearest to an open laptop on a desk. He used a knife to gouge the device out of its hiding place. It had been placed in a tiny pocket of drywall and then lightly plastered and painted over. Wires trailed down to the baseboard where they were threaded into the power cord for an ornate clock.
"Call it,"
he said.
"If they're listening, then they already know we're here."
"No alarm's going off," I said.
"Doesn't mean they don't know."
He looked at the sleeping girl.
"There is no part of this that doesn't feel hinky. I think we ought to wrap this up and get gone sooner than later."
"You got that shit right," I muttered. I bent over Mitrovich, and then I froze. His eyes had changed. Before, they were dark and intense, filled with fear and calculations. Now they were different. They seemed to be too wide, for one thing, and although he was looking directly at me, there was an unfocused quality about his stare. And then he screamed. "To hell with my knife. To hell with the big dog ready to bite his junk off." Mitrovich let loose with a massive, high-pitched shriek of total, blind, mad rage. Then he came up off the bed with such astounding speed and power, it knocked my knife away and set Ghost tumbling to the floor. There was no preparatory tensing of muscles, no sign that he was going to move. He was suddenly and totally in motion. He leaped from the bed and flung himself at me, driving me backward with astonishing force. His mouth lunged forward and his teeth snapped shut on the corner of my scout glasses, tearing them sideways, obscuring my vision. I pivoted as he drove me backward and clopped him hard on the side of the head, sending him crashing into a bureau. He hit really hard, and although it had to be painful, he spun off the impact and dove at me again, this time trying to bite my throat. Which is when Ghost hit him like a cruise missile, metal teeth clamping onto Mitrovich's thigh, high near the groin. Impossible to ever tell if it was a deliberate attack to the femoral artery or an unlucky accident, but suddenly blood geysered up. I grabbed Ghost and hauled him back, ordering him to release his bite. He did, but he took a chunk of meat with him. Mitrovich did not scream in pain. Instead, even with a mangled leg, he drove at me again, howling like a demon from the pit. My hand moved, and my knife moved with it, slapping across the man's throat, opening a second fire hydrant of blood. He dropped right there. All of this happened in the time, call it a second, that it took Top to run around the big bed and bring his Snellig up. He looked at me, and I shook my head. the fuck was that? Demanded Bunny, coming in from the hall. But I think we all knew what it was. And when we heard the wild screams from downstairs, it confirmed it. File it under worst-case scenario. Mitrovich, and maybe everyone else on the staff, had been dosed with a designer bioweapon Kuga had used on civilians in both North and South Korea, and on a mass of dignitaries, security people, politicians, and the press at the D9 denuclearization summit in Oslo, Norway. A bio-engineered neurotoxin made from the Loligo beta-microseminoprotein found in the longfin inshore squid. Once dosed, it drove everyone exposed to it into a state of total murderous fury. We called it rage. There was no cure except time, no way to manage it except Sandman, and it was too late for that. Mitrovich was bleeding out, and even if I'd wanted to save his life, that ship had sailed right off the edge of the planet. I whirled. "The lab," I yelled, and we ran from the room and thundered down the stairs, following the shrieks. They were coming from the same mudroom we'd used, except they stabbed outward through the very walls. I knew that it meant there was a hidden entrance, but damn if it didn't make me feel like we were in a haunted house. Or a haunted asylum. Interlude 4. Sales presentation via showroom 6 months ago.
"Please pardon the odd nature of this conference," said Mr. Sunday. "With the global pandemic, we're all forced to make adjustments. But also, let me assure you that our proprietary showroom video conferencing technology is bleeding edge. No one can participate without codes such as those sent to you. Anyone who tries will discover how disheartening malware, ransomware, and computer tapeworms can be." The man was smiling as he said it. He even exuded warmth. A charm that twinkled in his green eyes, sparkled from his white teeth, and glowed from his palpable and potent persona. Mr. Sunday wore a Brioni suit, dark blue with the faintest hint of a plaid in varying shades of thread on similar blues, a cream-white shirt and exceptional Stefano Ricci formal crystal silk tie. His shoes were Louis Vuitton Manhattan Richelieu made from waxed alligator leather. He wore a Richard Mille RM022 carbon tourbillon aerodyne dual time zone watch that retailed at just under $700,000. The diamond in his pinky ring was 2.7 carats, set into white gold, with 66 tiny emerald chips orbiting the great central stone. It was difficult to gauge his age on the video screen. He could have been 40 or 60, depending on the angle and where the colored lights hit him as he moved across the improvised stage. In blue light, he looked cadaverous, like a movie vampire. In green light, he became sinister, and those tones seemed to make his irises swirl with different shades of green and brown. But in the other shades, he was handsome and affable and looked like a moneyed entrepreneur and salesman. It was clear from this and previous showroom events that Mr. Sunday seemed to be enjoying the effect, and he often moved into unflattering or distortive lights when making certain points. The audience, 16 men and women scattered around the world on 6 continents, were riveted. "For the benefit of the 2 newbies to our little chat, I'd like to remind you that everyone can see me," said Mr. Sunday. "But for the sake of privacy and, well, security and discretion, none of you can see one another. I can hear you all, but when you speak, the others will only see your questions or comments as text. Is everyone comfortable? No need for a fresh cup of coffee or a bathroom break? No? Excellent. Let's begin, shall we? Are you with me? Good." He paused to smile at each of the 16 faces on the high-def screens. It amused him
that they were about as racially mixed as was likely in a meeting of high-roller industrialists and military buyers. It was all one big happy world to him, the more the merrier. Life was a goddamned peach if you knew how to pick the right fruit from the right tree. Instead of a standard clicker, Mr. Sunday had two tiny sensors on the thumb and ring fingers of his left hand. He tapped the sensors to send a video file to each of the participants. The same video played on a big screen behind him. Our first item today is a little crowd pleaser of a bioweapon intended for strategic population control, he said. It is volatile, but used correctly, is self-limiting. Unlike viral or bacterial bioweapons, this does not spread. There is no risk of a resulting pandemic because, let's face it, we're not trying to destroy the world. His laugh was rich and warm and knowing. There is a very specific delivery system for this, and after a certain amount of time, the substance itself becomes inert. Let's see how this works, shall we? It's highly entertaining. The video showed a group of four people, three men and a woman, seated on wooden chairs at a metal table in a room with very little furniture. There was a framed painting on the wall of a banal seascape, a generic sofa, and a small table with a coffee maker and fixings. The people were busy filling out forms using yellow #2 pencils. One of them suddenly looked up at a vent set high into the wall above them. He frowned at it, and over the speakers there was a faint hissing sound.
Inchida,
he said, and the video provided translation from Armenian. What is that? The others looked up. There was no obvious cause for alarm. No gas poured out of the vent, nothing but cool air with a few droplets of what appeared to be condensation. When nothing appeared to be amiss, they lost interest and returned to filling out what they believed were job applications. The man who'd first looked up was actually sitting farthest from the vent and was now fully engrossed in the form. The woman was almost directly under the vent, and she had stopped writing. None of the three men seemed to notice, or if they did, they didn't much care. People often paused when filling out forms, deciding on what to say, how to phrase it, or fishing for information. The image shifted, proof that there were several cameras in the room. It showed the woman's face. Her eyes seemed to become gradually glazed, as if she were daydreaming and lost deep in thought. One eye twitched, though, as did her fingers. She looked down at her pencil and studied it, as if it was something she'd never seen before. The woman turned it over, apparently fascinated by the graphite point. Then she turned and drove the pencil deep into the eye socket of the man closest to her. It was a very fast and very powerful blow, and the point exploded the man's eyeball. The man shrieked in absolute agony and absolute surprise. The other two men leaped up and back, staring in horror.
"Svat sim!"
cried one man.
"Inche saral!"
"My God, what have you done?" Those were the words that came out of his mouth, but as he spoke them, he grabbed the other uninjured man by the ears and slammed him face forward onto the table. Once. Twice, again and again and again. He did not stop, even as the other man's face broke apart and blood splattered everywhere. He did not stop as the front of the man's skull cracked like an egg. He did not stop even when one of the man's ears tore off. He did not stop even as the woman got up and rushed around to his side of the table and drove her pencil into his thighs and buttocks and lower back. He only stopped when she stabbed him in the back of the neck, and then he released the dying man and whirled, grabbed her by the throat, and strangled her. Her last act before his fingers crushed her windpipe was to drive the now broken point of the pencil into his throat just below the Adam's apple, punching a hole through the hyoid bone. The man drowned in his own blood, but he dragged the woman's corpse down to the floor with him. The first man, whose eye was destroyed, and who should have been incapacitated by the sheer pain and trauma, got sloppily to his feet and began stomping the two figures on the floor. He stomped and stomped and stomped until they no longer resembled human beings. Then he spun toward the door and tried to jerk open the handle, which was locked. The man howled with inhuman fury and began pounding on the door, with his fists, which disintegrated into pulp, with his feet and knees, and with his own face. He smashed his face repeatedly against the reinforced safety glass. He continued with unrelenting intensity until there was not enough left of his skull and brains. His knees buckled, and he sank down to the floor and flopped over, dead. Ruined. The door opened, and a guard had to shove hard to move the slumped body. Then two men with AK-47 machine guns entered and carefully shot all four of the people in the head, even the dead ones. The video file ended. Mr. Sunday was smiling as he looked down at his watch. "From the first onset of symptoms," he said, "to the elimination of all infected, 51 seconds. And in case anyone still has a lingering doubt, yes, this is the party favor used on the island of Gaegulisyom in North Korea, on Yeonpyeong Island in South Korea, and at the D9 conference in Oslo. It has a 100% effectiveness, no possible immunity. In practical application, this can be delivered via microdrones, introduced to drinking water, or sprayed in water vapor. Because it's not a bacterium or virus, it doesn't require special storage and can't infect the user. Are you with me still?" He watched the faces on all the screens, saw the interest and the repulsion. He was fine with either because it helped him select the best potential customers. "This bioweapon is available in limited quantities," he continued. "Introduce it to any contained target. A village of an inconvenient ethnic group, a military base, the offices of a corporate rival, even on an individual basis. It's much better than, say, a polonium pellet whose radiation and gas chromatograph signatures allow it to be traced. Better than the clumsy neurotoxins used by some of our colleagues. This weapon is unique and is tied to no specific country of origin. We call it Rage, for obvious reasons." He paused and dialed up the wattage on his smile. "Now, who would like to start the bidding at 1 billion euros? Chapter 8. Trstenik Island, Croatia. Top placed his palm flat on the wall, through which we could hear the screams most clearly.
"Sounds like inside and maybe down," he said. "I'm thinking basement here."
I called Andrea in from outside, but told Bell to hold position. Then I tapped into the talk channel and very quickly explained the situation about Mitrovic, the bugs we'd found, the girl, and the Rage. "We're going to need evac for the girl," I said. "Maybe other friendlies here." "Chopper is inbound," said Wilson. "ETA 14 minutes. Tell them not to stop for coffee." Andrea came in through the back door, his rifle ready, but he shifted the barrel away from us and pointed it at the wall. Fists were pounding on it with savage intensity.
"Dimmi che questo non è quello che penso ci sia,"
he breathed. "Tell me this isn't what I think it is."
"Rage," said Bunny. "Freaking Rage. I thought we were done with that shit."
"Why is that, farm boy?"
asked Top in his voice of reason tone.
"Just because we spanked them in Oslo doesn't mean they threw away all their toys. We've got to always be ready for them to use this."
"Which means," I said, "if any of us gets dosed, then someone else darts us. And if you get dosed and there's no one around, try to dart yourself before you lose your shit."
"Hoorah,"
they said, though without enthusiasm. Oslo, and the horrors we'd encountered on Gaegulisyom and Yeonpyeong Island in Korea were still recent and vivid in our minds. I punched the wall with the side of my fist. "We need to get in. Rage or not, we need to know what's down there. No need to keep it quiet.
If we don't need to stay quiet, said Andrea, then let me get out some toys.
He unslung his pack and began pulling stuff out. Bunny knelt to help him. Andrea Bianchi was on loan to RTI from the Gruppo di Intervento Speciale, an elite division of Italy's Carabinieri, which was a branch of their armed forces responsible for both military and civil policing. He was able to rig a bomb, cut a throat, or pick a lock with equal nonchalance. A lean man who looked like he worked in an office somewhere doing something unimportant, but who had become a critical part of Havoc Team. He took a blaster plaster from the bag and unrolled it. It looked like one of those gel packs used to ice a strained back, except that it was clear and thin. There was a network of wires through it and tiny little blisters of chemicals. He scanned the wall and found the probable doorway, then tore the adhesive off one side and pressed it in place.
Sta per diventare rumoroso qui,
he shouted as he backpedaled and then ran into the kitchen. It's about to get loud in here. We ducked down behind the big island as Andrea thumbed a small device. The explosion was massive, shaking the entire building. We crept back in and discovered that the entire wall was gone, obliterated by the blast. The heavy steel security door had been punched inward and lay drunkenly on the top steps of a metal stairway. Parts of the mudroom ceiling had come down, and the blast had blown the door to the outside and all the windows out.
"Holy monkey balls!"
gasped Andrea.
"Think you used enough?"
asked Bunny. Andrea shrugged.
"Didn't want to have to ask twice."
I had my Snellig in my hands and leaned into the stairway. There were three bodies on the steps, each badly mangled by the blast. One was dressed in the same nondescript clothes as the guards outside. One was in a lab coat. The third was a woman wearing white capri pants and a scarlet blouse. Except the blouse wasn't supposed to be that color. The blast had torn her arm and head off. At the bottom of the staircase were a few other people, mostly technicians in white coats. They looked dazed, and most were bleeding. I trained my gun on them, and Top leaned in and did the same with his Snellig rifle. We watched the people get to their feet, shaking heads like befuddled dogs.
"Give me a happy ending," I murmured.
"Day ends with a Y," said Top sourly.
The people down there suddenly all looked up. Whether drawn by the sound of our voices or driven by some chemical force, it was hard to say. They glared at us. They bared their teeth, and with a mingled howl of murderous joy, they charged up the stairs.
Chapter 9. The Playroom. Undisclosed location near Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada, 6 days ago.
"Do you have it?"
Mr. Sunday stood beside his car, his face in dense shadows thrown by a massive old pine tree. The sunlight was so bright, and the shadows so dark, that the dividing line between made the salesman look as if he were cut in half. Kuga did not offer to shake hands, neither did Sunday. It wasn't that kind of moment.
"I got it," said Kuga, holding up a thick, padded envelope.
"Blood and hair?"
"Took some doing. We had to get it from an Oslo evidence locker, not easy and not cheap."
"The effort will be worth it,"
said Sunday. Kuga did not immediately hand over the envelope.
"You know, man, this is some real spooky shit right here. This whole thing?"
"Yes."
"How do I know you're not just running some kind of weird psycho head trip on me?"
"You can't know either way,"
said Sunday. Although Kuga couldn't see the big smile with all that darkness, he could feel it. That awareness gave him the creeps.
"Shit."
"There's still time to back out," said Sunday. "Just throw that envelope away and forget we ever had this meeting."
Kuga looked at the envelope, at the shadows, and up into the sky. It was blue overhead, but a storm front was troubling the horizon, and there were flocks of black birds, ragged-looking crows or starlings, flying toward those clouds. He didn't like the way that made him feel. He sighed heavily and held out the envelope. A pale hand reached out of the shadows and plucked it from his fingers. The envelope vanished into the shadows, and Kuga heard the seal rip open.
"This will be fun,"
said Mr. Sunday, though for just a moment his voice sounded different, rougher, stranger, with a different accent, not southern, but foreign. Italian? And it was a much, much older voice. Sunday got into his car, keeping his face turned away from Kuga, who stood watching as the car backed up, turned, and drove in the same direction as the black birds. Chapter 10. Trstenik Island, Croatia. Top and I opened fire as we began walking down the stairs. Sandman did its work, dropping them one after another. I heard Bunny's heavy steps on the stairs behind me, and Andrea's lighter footfalls. Ghost stood on the stairs and barked. Had I told him to stay back? I couldn't remember. Or maybe he had been in enough biohazardous situations by now to follow his own wisdom. We reached the floor and immediately formed a half circle around the base of the stairs, each of us firing. There were maybe 20 people down there. They came at us with bare hands and snapping teeth. Others grabbed whatever they could use as weapons to smash us. A chair, a piece of pipe, a screwdriver, a mop. The choice of weapon didn't matter. All that filled their minds was an unbearable need to hurt, to kill. I understood that need. I'd felt it in Oslo when I'd been sprayed with rage and tried my best to kill everyone, including my own team. I went after Belle and she'd shot me with Sandman, but damn, that rage was real. It was an emotion so real, so pure that it crowded everything else out. It was genuine. It defined me in that moment. I would have killed her and Top and Bunny and anyone else I could have gotten my hands on, or my teeth. In those few moments, nothing else mattered to me. The rage was my life, my heart, and my God, as it was to these poor bastards. I felt a flicker of empathy for them, and with it came that insidious compassion infused with rationalization. Maybe they didn't know they worked for Kuga. Maybe they didn't understand the uses to which whatever they were doing down here would be put. Maybe they didn't know that their boss, Mitrovich, was a pedophile who raped and abused young girls. Maybe, maybe, maybe. None of that stopped my finger from pulling the pistol. Not sure it would have stopped me if I was pulling the trigger on a more lethal weapon. The three aspects of my fractured personality were all engaged in this. The modern man, that normal aspect, was yelling that this was merciful, that once subdued, they could be treated, helped, rehabilitated. The cop was being his pragmatic self, arguing that dropping all these people would allow us access to the physical assets of machinery, computers, samples, and reminding me that if there were bioweapons of any kind here, they'd be sealed in safety containers and flown out to where Dr. John Smarr and his bug hunter team were waiting on a biohazard containment barge 40 miles off the coast. And the killer, the savage hunter in my head, just wanted to eliminate the enemy and maybe look for whomever might be down here. More girls like the one upstairs, or test subjects for rage or other dreadful concoctions. So my finger pulled and pulled, and the bodies dropped. There was another presence inside my head. Not a voice, per se, though it did sometimes whisper to me. Usually at night, when I was deep in a nightmare recreation of Christmas Eve, watching Santoro, dressed in a Santa hat and beard, deliver a box to my brother Sean, handing it to him, smiling as he drove away in his stolen FedEx truck. The memory of my brother carrying the box inside, likely to set it down so his hands would be free for hugs with me and Junie Flynn. And then my realization that the port wine stain on the FedEx driver's face was not that at all, but a healing bruise from the fight we'd had in Norway. The package exploded, killing everyone inside the house, nearly killing Junie and Ghost and me. And in the weeks of recovery that followed, I became aware of that new presence. Not another facet of my splintered personality, nothing as sane as that. No. This was like a sentient and lightless cloud of dark energy that was trying to take possession of me, body, mind, and soul. A pernicious shadow thing born of a loss so deep that I could not and cannot process it. In the lexicon of my own damage, I called it the darkness. As the screaming people closed around us and we fired the tranquilizer darts at them, the darkness kept trying to pull my hand down to make me holster or drop the Snellig and reach for the Sig Sauer with its full magazine of copper-jacketed hollow points. That ache, that temptation, that need was so damn strong, and so much of me wanted to give in to it. Out of a weariness of fighting it, and out of a desire to be it. The last of the technicians fell, and there was a moment of an awful silence. We were surrounded by a wall of bodies. There was no haze of gun smoke or shuddering gasps of the dying. The people lay in heaps, each of them sleeping. Almost all of them were bloody, though, not just from us. Rage is not targeted. It doesn't direct the infected toward an enemy. All humans were the enemy, and so before we'd entered the scene, they had been attacking one another. Beyond the ring of unconscious people were a half dozen corpses, some badly dismembered. One man had almost no head, and from the shape of the pulped mass of what was left, someone had stomped his head to jelly. A woman lay against a row of filing cabinets, her skirt pushed up, and her legs spread so wide they'd clearly become dislocated. She had been violated with a long-barreled flashlight. A man had dozens of pencils shoved into each of his eye sockets.
"Psycho wombat balls," breathed Andrea.
Bunny shook his head.
"Fuck me sideways."
I looked around. We were in what looked like a computer center. Dozens of workstations, supercomputers off to one side behind glass in a cooled room, and rows of file cabinets of various sizes. "Spread out and search this place," I said, as Ghost crept down to stand beside me. He was quivering with nervous energy. "Jackpot, disconnect the computers from any power source, cable, or landline. Pappy and Donnie Darko, assess the tech and bag anything we need to take."
"Too much to take," said Bunny.
"Prioritize," I told him. There was a corridor leading off the room, and I thought I heard some muffled sounds coming from there. "Ghost and I will check that out," I said. Once I rounded the bend, I saw that the corridor ran 40 feet to a big door on rails, like a barn door, and made out of oak planks, very sturdy, and with a big industrial deadbolt lock. No way to tell if it was locked from the outside or inside. I had a blaster plaster with me, but I didn't want to injure anyone if there were prisoners or test subjects incarcerated there. However, there was a glass case inset into the wall near where I stood that had a red fire extinguisher bracketed in between a heavy flathead fire axe. I paused to reload the Snellig, then used the butt of the pistol to smash the glass, then holstered the dart gun. I pulled the axe from the aluminum clips. Like the extinguisher, it was painted a vivid red to make it easier to see in smoky situations, with the blade coated in clear, rust-resistant lacquer. It had a bright yellow 36-inch fiberglass handle and felt solid and sturdy in my hands as I approached the door. The muffled sounds I'd heard earlier were definitely coming from there. I leaned close, but the sounds were odd and indistinct. No screams, though. None of the rage-infused mania. "Get back," I said to Ghost. "Watch." He walked backward 15 feet and sat, eyes alert, ears swiveling, nose sniffing the air. I braced my feet, grasped the neck of the handle a few inches below the X's head, with my palm facing away, making sure my grip was firm but not tense. Then, as I swung it down, using muscle, posture, and gravity to accelerate and gather force, my top hand slid down to meet the other, creating a nice fulcrum to deliver that power. The way my father had taught me to split logs on his brother's farm. The farm where they all died. The blade bit deeply into the wood and splinters flew into the air. I kept swinging, feeling my muscles flow through the movement, accepting the jolt of each impact, allowing the shock to travel up and out through unresisting tissue before tugging the blade free again. And again. The wood was thick and did not want to break apart, but the axe and my own brand of personal rage offered a more compelling argument. Suddenly, the whole lock assembly toppled onto the floor and the door swung inward. I shifted the axe to my left hand and drew the snellig with my right, then kicked the door open and stepped in, fading to one side, sweeping the room with eyes and gun barrel tracking together. I have long ago stopped requiring proof that you don't need to die to enter hell. What I saw was out of something by Dante, or maybe Bosch. Or maybe this is what the U.S. 7th Army's 45th Infantry Division saw and felt when they liberated Dachau. The people were chained to the beds with leg irons and bound with leather belts across waist and chest, wrists secured by cuffs. Many were naked, their bodies punctured by wires and IV lines and electrodes surgically drilled into their skulls and sternums. They were a cross-section of humanity with no apparent bias toward one race. More than half were. The room stank of urine, feces, blood, sweat, antiseptic, and human misery. Stepping into that room was like being punched in the soul, and that blow was damned near crippling. Eyes turned toward me with fresh horror, seeing a big man dressed for combat, armed with an axe and a gun, and a combat dog with blood on his muzzle. Those who could scream did. A few begged for mercy from God or cried out for their mothers. The little ones merely screamed. And behind the beds were a dozen technicians in stained lab coats. They cringed back against the far wall as if they could distance themselves from my awareness of what they were doing here. As if holding up hands was all that they'd need to escape punishment for their crimes. As if trying to look weak and helpless and pitiable would be effective. I heard Bunny calling my name, asking about my status. The snellig slipped from my fingers and clattered to the concrete floor. I tore the comms unit from my ear and ground it underfoot. I slammed the door through which I'd just entered and pulled a heavy steel work table in front of it. Then I began walking toward the cringing technicians. I passed between rows of children covered in surgical scars, some still with stitches from God only knew what kind of obscene experimentation. I don't know why these technicians, nurses, and doctors were not infected by rage when the facility failsafe was triggered. Maybe they were too senior, too valuable to what was going on, to what Kuga and Centauro had intended for this place. I also didn't care. I kept walking, trying not to let the horrors on either side of me cripple my progress. The overhead fluorescence threw my shadow across the faces of the cowering. They screamed for mercy. They begged for mercy. But I hadn't brought any mercy with me. I stood in the doorway, chest heaving, sweat running down my body inside my clothes. The room was far too bright, and every sound was terribly loud. I looked down at the axe in my hands. I could hear Bunny yelling from outside the room. Top two. Ghosts stood at the door and barked at them. My team were all outside. Kuga's people were inside, with me. Here with me. And my axe. In my heart and head. The darkness roiled and twisted and finally broke free.
Chapter 11. Freetech Research and Development Office, San Diego, California. Junie Flynn was in the act of lifting a glass of wine to her lips when she suddenly shuddered with such unexpected violence that the wine sloshed and the glass slipped from her twitching fingers. It struck the side of the work table and exploded, showering her and her companion with tiny, glittering fragments. Then Junie staggered back, a hand going to her throat.
"What's wrong?"
cried Toys, a young man whose normally stern face twisted into a look of mingled shock and concern.
"I..."
she began, and then her eyes rolled high and she puddled down to the floor. Toys caught her under the neck and back, inches from the floor. He squatted, grunted, and picked her up. She was a tall woman, and he was a man below middle height, but he was wiry and much stronger than he looked. Toys carried her quickly to the adjoining staff lounge, kicking the door open and laying her down on a leather couch. Junie was totally out, and he quickly took her pulse. Finding the steady heartbeat was not entirely comforting because it fluttered like hummingbird wings on a window of a house in which it had gotten trapped. He felt her head, but there was no sign of a fever. Toys pulled a cell phone from his jeans pocket and punched 911. When the call was answered, he said,
"I need an ambulance at..."
"No," said Junie sharply.
"No, please. Toys, don't. I'm okay."
He glanced down at her.
"You're sorting well, aren't you? Dropped into a dead faint." "Please," she said, gesturing weakly to the phone. "No ambulance."
Toys explored the inside of his mouth with his tongue, a habit he had when he was trying to decide something on the fly. Then he said,
"Sorry, my mistake,"
and disconnected the call. He dropped to his knees beside the couch and took her hand.
"To quote your beefcake boyfriend, what in the wide blue fuck was that?"
Clouds of doubt passed across her features. Junie was a little older than Toys, but normally exuded youthful energy and strength. Anyone who didn't know her and didn't look too closely merely saw a woman with masses of wavy blonde hair, sky blue eyes, and a wholesome smile that was so infectious it made other people smile without knowing why or even being aware they were doing it. But when they looked closely, they saw small lines of care around her mouth and at the corners of her eyes, lines that may have been born as laugh lines, but that had been deepened by stress, awareness, and pain. Life had been unkind to Junie in ways none of the other employees at Freetech knew about. Toys did, because they were friends on that special level where there are no secrets. Just as Junie knew about Toys and his very checkered past. Their life paths had made them freakish by any normal standards, but there was a bonding in that. They both were from what Junie's lover, Joe Ledger, called the Stormlands. It gave the refugees from life's more troubled places a shared understanding that ran deeper than mere empathy. It taught them a language that often did not require words and whose aspects seldom had appropriate adjectives.
"What's going on with you?"
he asked. His accent, though refined by education and world travel, easily echoed the Essex town of Purfleet, where he'd grown up hard in a bad neighborhood and a worse home. This was long before the local government changed it to the more upscale-sounding Purfleet-on-Thames, as part of an intended gentrification.
"Since when do you get the vapors, you silly cow?"
"It wasn't that,"
she began, but paused.
I finish your sentence for me, there's a good lass."
Junie pushed herself up to a sitting position while Toys watched, studying her eyes and complexion to look for a drop in blood pressure. She seemed fine, though,
if a bit pale.
"It was so weird," she said. "I mean, I never faint."
"Because you're not an ingenue from a Victorian drawing room novel," he said. "So why did you faint? You feeling sick?"
"No, it's not that."
"Then what?" asked Toys.
I think it was Joe."
Toys made a moue of disapproval.
"What about him?"
Junie rubbed her face with her hands and looked around the room as if she'd never seen it before. When she looked back at Toys, he saw tears glittering like small diamonds in the corners of her eyes. They broke and fell down her cheeks. The sight touched him, softening his natural antagonism every time Ledger's name was mentioned. The dislike they shared of each other was rooted in just cause and had memories of hurt and harm heaped over it. He waited for Junie to find the words to say what disturbed her so deeply.
"I think he's in trouble,"
she said. Toys smiled.
"Oh, honey, he's always in trouble. That man could get into trouble alone in an empty room."
But Junie shook her head and her ashen skin went paler still.
"No, I mean, in real trouble. I mean, I'm not talking him being in physical danger. He lives for that stuff. No, Toys, I think Joe is in real trouble."
As she said that, her fingers brushed her forehead and then fell down to touch the spot on her chest over her heart. Chapter 12. Nowhere. He sat in near total darkness. A single votive candle burned, and it cast a circle of pale, trembling light. None of that light touched the man who sat cross-legged on the floor. He was naked, his pale body veined with twisted lines of black and red, as if every part of him was rife with disease and those diseases warred within him. That was unseen, always, by any eyes but his own, and the few unfortunate women who made the mistake of falling for his smile and his charm. Women whose bodies were seldom recovered, and never whole. The room was quiet except for the faint buzz of insect wings. Flies crawled across the floor and around the rim of the hammered copper bowl. One snuck down into the bowl and lapped at the stinking red liquid. It had been left to rot in this room, and that excited the flies. They, like the man, found the smell to be quite exquisitely exciting. The man picked up a box of Lucifer matches and struck one, enjoying the flare of heat. He was always cold. Always. He let the match burn for a moment, then picked up the photograph and studied it. It was a picture of a man printed from surveillance camera footage, good quality, though a bit blurred since the man was in motion. A tall, powerful, fierce man with pale eyes and paler hair. He did not hate this man. He only hated one person on earth, but that one was beyond the reach of a ceremony like this. No, he rather loved this blonde man with the icy blue killer's eyes. A man like this was a child of chaos, and every child of chaos was the conjurer's brother. He loved them all. The light of the match brightened the room, allowing the yellow glow to reach as far as the clothes and jewelry and skin he had removed. Then he touched the flame to the corner of the photograph and watched as the golden fingers reached up the face, blackening the paper, charring the grim countenance of the killer. When only the small corner he held was unburnt, he dropped it into the bowl of putrefying blood and strands of hair. It flashed and flared and burned with such lovely colors, green and brown in all their baser shades. He sat there, naked, reeking, smiling, and watched it all burn until there was nothing left in the bowl but a smear of darkness. Chapter 13. Trstenik Island, Croatia.
Mary, Mother of God.
I heard Bunny's voice behind me, but I didn't turn. I was afraid of what he'd see in my eyes. The axe was heavy in my hands, the handle slick. The stink of copper was sharp in my nose, despite the balaclava I still wore. Behind me, the people in the beds had all fallen silent. They'd screamed for a while, awful screams that I'd only been able to hear distantly, as if they were on the other side of a thick curtain or in another world.
Top, is it rage? Is Outlaw infected?
I shook my head but could not speak.
Outlaw,
said another voice. Top. I looked down at my hand, which was red to the wrist. My knuckles were tight against my skin, my fingers clutching the axe handle so tightly it hurt. The pain felt good, though. Footsteps a little closer. Then a hand on my forearm, strong, steady. Top's hand. For some reason, he'd taken off his glove, and I saw his brown fingers curl around mine. Felt the pressure as he coaxed my hand to release the tool. The axe slipped, and Top caught it. He tossed it away. We both watched it hit the concrete, striking sparks before it went slithering and rasping across the floor and vanished under a bed. The inmate of that bed was a man in his 40s who lay staring at the ceiling with eyes that appeared to see everything or nothing at all. Ghost whined softly, the sound as heart-piercing as a troubled child trying to punch his way out of a nightmare.
It's not rage, murmured Top. This is...
He let the rest hang. I still said nothing. Top took my arm, turning me to face him. He'd removed his goggles and balaclava. His face looked 10 years older than it should have, seamed and sad, his eyes filled with concern. I looked past him to where Bunny, the big keyring in his hands, was working to unlock the prisoners. Andrea stood in the doorway, goggles and hood still on, but tension written in his body language. Bunny glanced at Top and me, and then his eyes slid away. I was covered in blood. It was all over my clothes, glistening darkly like oil. It was on my hands and splashed across the lenses of the scout glasses. Top stood in front of me, the heel of his hand resting on the butt of his Snellig dart gun.
Do I need to get you out?
I said, what? Oh. No. His eyes seemed to drill into mine. I saw concern, doubt, something else. My perceptions were so warped, I don't know what emotions I was really seeing.
Why don't you go upstairs and wait on the chopper?
Top said gently.
You don't need to be down here. You've done your part. We can handle the rest.
I looked at him for a long time. 5 seconds? 10? Then I nodded and shambled to the door. Ghost followed me along the hall and upstairs to the entrance foyer. I was about to reach for the door handle, then paused and turned to look up the stairs. I thought about the young girl in Mitrovich's bed. No matter how much medical and psychological help we provided her, she would always remember what he'd done to her. It made me think of Helen, about how her body healed but her heart and mind never did. Some women can come a long way back from the horror and violence of rape, but is it possible to come all the way? I didn't think so. Those thoughts banged around in the haunted house of my head, and I almost didn't realize that I was climbing the stairs. There were moments when I saw myself doing that, and moments that seemed lost. Then I was in the master bedroom. Mitrovich and the girl were both on the bed, separated by 5 feet, each of them wrapped in individual cocoons of nightmare because of Sandman, so
Yeah, we'd done that. To keep a rape victim from screaming, I'd shot her with a drug that would fill her mind with awful hallucinations. What kind of a total piece of shit was I? How had I even managed to pull the trigger of the dart gun? How? How? I looked down at my hand and saw that I was holding my gun. Not the Snellig, no. It was the Sig Sauer. I watched my left hand reach across to rack the slide. It was like watching a movie. I saw it, but didn't feel it. Nor did I feel the gun buck as it fired. And fired. And fired. The shell casings glittered as they arced away from the weapon. I blinked, looking at the utter ruin of Mitrovich's face and head. I blinked again, and I was downstairs. My gun was holstered. Had I fired it? Had I even been upstairs? To save my own soul, I could not say. Ghost was watching me, his eyes dark and intense. I could feel his gaze penetrate all my defenses and see deep inside. I knew he was seeing more than I was. I reached for the doorknob, and we stepped out into the night. I pulled off the scout glasses and let them fall, did the same with the balaclava and the tactical computer on my forearm, limb pads next, rifle, all of it, except for my clothes. Ghost followed me, stepping over the items I discarded. Belle was still in her tower, so we took a route that was out of her line of sight. In the distance, I could hear the heavy, thropping sound of helicopter rotors, at least three or four of them. At least one big Chinook with a medical team to take care of the people down in that room. With each step away from that building, I felt another piece of myself fall away. The voices inside my head, the modern man, the cop, and the killer had all fallen silent, and the default now was silence, wrapped around some purely objective thoughts. Step this way, avoid that tripwire. Then Ghost and I were down on the beach. When the choppers passed over, I stepped back beneath the shade of a massive oak. Ghost crouched beside me. The helos landed on the lawn, and I went the other way, moving along the beach past the place where we'd buried the motor kites, around to the western side of the island, where a pier ran 150 feet into the black waters of the Adriatic. There was a big Lursen superyacht moored at the end of the pier, which told me there had to be deep water out there, and four small craft, including a pair of Scout 355 LXF fishing boats and a German Cigarette 59 Tirana with six matched Mercury outboard racing engines and a hull built for speed, 65 feet long with nearly 14 feet of beam. Once again I heard a rustling sound like dry leaves and turned to see more of the night birds. They were everywhere. On the nearby trees, in the grass, on the dock, and on every flat surface of the moored boats. Hundreds of them, maybe thousands. And every set of beady black eyes was turned in my direction. Ghost made a small sound that was somewhere between discomfort and a warning. His bushy white tail was tucked between his legs. "It's okay, boy," I said, and it felt like a lie. The birds fluttered their wings. I undid the lines, climbed aboard, and slid into the pilot seat. Ghost lay down on the other seat. The keys were in the ignition. The tanks were 3/4 full, which would give me a range of about 600 nautical miles, even running at a top speed of 72 knots. Italy was a hell of a lot closer than that. From there, I could go anywhere on Earth. The engine started with a growl, and it was loud enough to smother any wandering thoughts. I could feel the darkness coiling inside me, wrapped around my windpipe, trying to choke me, cold, like a snake. Before I hit the gas, though, I caught something out of the corner of my eye. There was a group of people standing on the dock. A tall, middle-aged man. A younger man who had the same posture, the same eyes as the older man. A pretty woman, and a couple of kids. They stood watching me, their faces pale as candles, their eyes filled with horror at what I had done. I wanted to tell my family I was sorry, but the thing is, I wasn't sorry. Not at all. I pressed down slowly on the gas, and the boat moved away from the pier. I aimed it toward the darkest part of the western horizon. Interlude 5. Blue Diamond Elite Training Center, Stevens County, Washington, 5 months ago. Rafael Santoro and Kuga climbed out of the Escalade into dappled sunlight. It had been nearly 2 months since either of them had been to this place, and they took a few minutes to look around and admire the work. Quonset huts painted in camouflage greens, browns, and blacks, heavy canopies over everything to reduce surveillance from satellites, planes, or drones, and lots of activity.
How many people do we have here now?
Asked Kuga.
47 support staff and 411 soldiers under training, said Santoro. Add 30 in the science and research staff.
Nice. Kuga turned back toward the car. Hey, Barbie, move your ass.
I don't want to,
came the petulant voice of Eve from the shadows of the back seat.
Come here regardless, my girl, snapped Santoro. It was not a suggestion.
There was a comically loud put-upon sigh, and then Eve emerged from the Escalade. She wore a tight camo t-shirt and loose pants, with a sidearm hanging low like a Western movie gunslinger.
Why are we even here?
Santoro snapped his fingers and pointed to the ground next to where the two men stood. Eve huffed and trudged over.
Ask your question again with manners this time, said the Spaniard.
Eve started to say something, then caught the look in Santoro's eyes. She took a beat and then tried again.
You never said why we were coming out here except that it would be educational.
She leaned on the word as if it were a side dish of Brussels sprouts.
So please tell me why we came all the way out here. Is this about that dumb G-55 American thing?
Yes, said Santoro, and other things.
If Eve had any additional comments, she kept them to herself because a woman with a pretty face and a bright smile came walking briskly over. She had her hair in a comfortable bun and clutched a clipboard to her chest. Her smile was large and infectious, and even Santoro found himself smiling.
My dears,
she said brightly, extending a hand to Kuga and a cheek to be kissed, then repeated that with Santoro.
And who's your little friend?
Santoro placed his hand on Eve's lower back and pushed her gently forward.
This is my protege, Eve, he said smoothly. Eve, this is Jill Hamilton Kretschik, the director of our recruitment and training program.
This is Eve?
The woman looked interested.
You never told me she was such a beauty.
Eve colored and offered a hand and was uncharacteristically shy about it. Santoro was amused. Eve was never shy around men, but with powerful women the girl had a tendency toward deference.
Hello, Miss Hamilton Kretschik.
She stumbled a bit over the name.
It's a mouthful, said the woman. Call me HK. Everyone does. Okay, Miss HK. I mean...
She colored a deeper shade of red and stopped talking. HK leaned close and kissed her cheek. Then to the three of them, she said,
Your timing couldn't be better. I can give you a full tour later, but there's something going on in Building 36 I believe you'll really enjoy.
Let's do it, said Kuga, and they followed HK through the camp to the largest of the Quonset huts, nestled back beneath the furry arms of four massive pine trees.
A sentry in full body armor and black fatigues snapped to attention as they walked inside. The hut was crammed with people. Hundreds sat on bleachers, many with notebooks open on their laps and pens, scribbling busily. Others were on the floor working in teams. Some of these were shirtless, wearing only pants and boots. Others were in full combat kit. A few wore bulky body armor of a kind Eve had never seen. They were paired up, going through combat drills at dangerously high speeds. Both combatants in each team held knives, and although the blades were not sharp, they weren't exactly dull either. Quite a few of the soldiers bled from cuts, and a few of those injuries were deep. The training mats on which they worked were spackled with sweat and blood. But Eve's gaze was soon jerked away from the bloody drill as she saw what was playing out on a large movie screen that hung down at the back of the hut. On it, two other men were fighting, and it was no drill. One man was a total stranger and wore some kind of security company uniform that Eve was unfamiliar with. The other man was tall, very fit, lean, with blonde hair and icy blue eyes. He moved with an oiled grace that was deceptive because his movements were so economical. There was nothing wasted, no obvious concession to style. He simply moved at the right time and was never there when the attacker's blade came at him. Not that the man evaded every attack, but when he was cut, there was no flinch, no facial reaction, and no hesitation at all. He responded to each attack as a direct counterattack, often cutting the attacking arm during the attack or shadowing it back to cut during the withdrawal. The opponent was a mass of blood, and as soon as he began to tire, the big blonde man moved in like a blur and in less than a second slashed his blade across his opponent's inner thigh, the biceps, and the throat. Eve felt herself floating, as if somehow a cloud of burning rage was lifting her off the ground. There he was, 40 feet tall, right in front of her, with at least 60 soldiers training to mimic and beat the man's ruthlessly efficient fighting style. Eve wanted to cry. She wanted to scream. She wanted a knife so she could stab someone to death. If not him, then anyone close. She wanted to stab someone in the eyes, in the balls, in the heart. A hand closed around her shoulder and Eve spun, trying to slap away the grip, throwing a punch with all her speed and fury and hurt. But Rafael Santoro's grip was iron, and with his other hand he parried the blow. "Calm yourself, child," he said softly. Kuga and HK watched with surprise and amusement. Tears sprang into Eve's eyes. They burned, hotter than acid.
"Ledger,"
she snarled, and there was so much pure and unfiltered hatred in that one word, in that name, that several of the closest people on the bleachers turned in surprise.
"Ledger,"
agreed Santoro.
"And this, my daughter, is how we'll destroy him."
Chapter 14. Trstenik Island, Croatia. Top Sim stood on the pier and stared at the black water. The ripples were limned with faint red from a reluctant dawn. He was alone, but spoke aloud in a normal tone of voice, normal in volume, but twisted with doubt and fear and sorrow.
"He took a boat," he said. "Don't know how long ago. Pretty sure he took the cigarette boat we saw in the satellite photos, and you're telling me you can't find a 59-foot racing boat on a sea as small as the Adriatic? It's what, only 500 miles long and 120 wide? How's that even possible?"
"Satellites aren't in geostationary orbit, Pappy," said Scott Wilson, speaking from the talk 500 miles away. "We retasked a CIA eye in the sky to sync up with your infiltration, but it's necessarily moved on."
"All due respect, Grendel," said Top, using Wilson's call sign, "but you can shove that answer where the sun don't shine. Outlaws on a boat in the..."